give them a choice. They can either celebrate what we did or take Pilot's side in a media war. I don't think they'll choose door number two. You're a smart guy, Lucas said. We'll do it your way. And that's what they did. As state cops raced from one house to another in a circle 30 miles across, a captain named Ferguson took Lucas aside for a statement, and Lucas followed Laurent's proposed story. When they were done with him, they told him to hang around for a while. They were having the interview transcribed, and he'd have to sign it. Laurent had been given the same treatment, as was everyone else who'd been involved in actual shooting, including 3 civilians from the bar who'd opened up on the Naked Disciples after the deputies were shot. The lady artist's camera and memory card were confiscated over her protests. The state cops told her that she'd probably get them back sooner or later. After the interview, Lucas was out in the street when 2 TV cameramen came jogging up, led by good-looking women with microphones.
Officer Davenport, could you give us a comment, your version?
I better leave that to the Michigan State Police. I understand that they're planning a press conference. He saw Laurent and Frizzell watching, and he waved them over and said to the reporters, "Here are 2 of the main men in the whole operation. What they did, taking out this gang, it was right on the edge of unbelievable. I've never seen anything quite like it, to tell you the truth. Everybody in Michigan should be proud about what they did up here today." The reporters got a more extensive commentary out of Laurent and Frizzell, and then Laurent called Barney Peters over, and Lucas told the story of Peters doing first aid on the wounded. Late that afternoon, a woman named Constance Frey called to say that her husband, Louis Frey, had heard about the shootout in Mellon, and, despite her protests, had gotten his gun and jumped in his truck to help out. He had not come home and was not answering his cell phone. During his debriefing, Lucas had mentioned that they'd tracked some of the disciples with cell phones. A state police officer approached Lucas and asked if Lucas could ping Louis Frey's cell phone to see where he was.
"We could do it ourselves, but since you're already set up to do it..."
Lucas did, and was told that the cell phone was a mile or so south of town, right on the road. When they went to look, they couldn't find Frey. They began calling his phone as they walked along the road, and eventually heard it ringing from behind some brush across the roadside ditch. He'd been shot once in the head, but for some reason was still alive, though he couldn't move and couldn't talk. They loaded him into a police car and sent him to the hospital in Munising. One of the state cops told Lucas,
"I know you were doing the right thing by chasing these assholes down, but I wish you'd done it in some other state."
Lucas thought, "Fuck it," declined a ride back to town, and walked back by himself. Halfway back, he took a phone call from Jenkins.
"I'm standing here with Shrake and Julie Katz and her cadaver dog."
Lucas had lost track of who was doing what with the Marion case. It seemed like he'd last talked to Jenkins or Shrake about 100 years earlier.
"At Marion's cabin?" "Across the road from his cabin. The fucking dog indicated. Is that what they call it? Indicated?" "Yeah. Anyway, he indicated... and we're looking at the end of one of those banister things. I don't see any blood, but the dog says it's there. We've stopped digging. We're getting the crime scene crew out there."
"Good doggy," Lucas said. "Listen, my buddy Park Rains is going to claim that you guys planted it. It won't work, because if there's blood, we'll get DNA from it, and if Marion handled it, we could have his DNA, too. But Park's gonna say that you planted it, so don't touch anything."
"We haven't touched anything."
"Good. Call the sheriff's department and ask them to send a couple of deputies to stand guard so you won't be involved anymore," Lucas said.
"What about you?"
"What do you mean?" Lucas asked.
"You ought to be here for this when the news gets out," Jenkins said. "You know, for the glory." "Yeah, whatever," Lucas said. Get the ball rolling. For Christ's sakes, don't contaminate anything. Hey, Jenkins. You got him. You fucking got him.
Made him happy, and he picked up the pace. Called Weather with the news and told her, I can't get back tonight. I'll be back tomorrow.
You don't have to hurry. Don't try to drive back at 100 miles an hour.
When Lucas got back to Mellon, Peters and Frizzell were sitting on a bench outside the convenience store eating ice cream cones. It was a hot day, and Frizzell said,
You better get one if you want one. This place doesn't usually have a herd of reporters and cops hanging around, and they're going fast.
Everything's going fast, Peters added. Lucas got the last Diet Coke and the second to last cone and came back out, and Frizzell and Peters moved over so he'd have a place to sit. Frizzell looked down the street to where state crime scene people were making measurements and calculating angles and taking photographs.
I think Clooney will probably play me in the movie, he said.
Frizzell looked at Peters and Lucas.
How about you guys?
Peters said.
Tom Cruise.
Lucas thought for a moment and said,
Scarlett Johansson.
Frizzell said,
Really? Is there something you haven't told us?
No, no. It's just that I'm sure she'd need first-person coaching through the part. Some in-depth consultation, Lucas said.
Probably,
Peters said, catching a drip that was running down the side of his cone. To Frizzell, he said,
I'm changing mine to Angelina Jolie.
At the Holiday Inn that night, Lucas had just gotten out of the shower when Weather called and said,
Is there any way to see Channel 3 up there?
I don't know how, he said. Why?
Because you're in a couple of big stories, she said. We just saw the promo for them. Hang on, Letty wants to talk to you.
Letty came on and said,
Dad?
You still hurting?
Yeah, but never mind. Can you get online?
I got Wi-Fi in the room, he said.
Then you can watch Channel 3 online. You gotta hurry.
Lucas was right at the top of the news, in a way. First was the story out of Michigan, video from the reporters who'd talked to Lucas, Laurent, Frizzell, and Peters that afternoon, about the fight in Mellon, which was being headlined as High Noon in the UP. The second item was a press conference called by the BCA to announce that further important evidence had been discovered in the Ben Marion murder case in the shape of a bloody club found near Marion's Cross Lake cabin. Henry Sands made the announcement, attributing the find to hard-working BCA detectives, without mentioning names but his own, and to BCA laboratory personnel who would be processing the evidence through the St. Paul laboratory. We won't know the DNA results for some days, but I have been told that there is a substantial evidentiary sample available to us. He talked for a while, with the TV people calling out, Director Sands! Director Sands! Director Sands!
23.
Pilot and Kristen worked their way north to Prospect Avenue, got on I-75 and headed for Sault Ste. Marie, away from the blockaded bridge. They drove around town and found what they were looking for on 10th Avenue West, an area of older homes, probably from the post-World War II era, small houses on large lots. They spent some time cruising the whole area, then did it again and then a third time, until Pilot pointed and said,
There, right there.
A white-haired woman was pulling her tourist station wagon into a detached two-car garage. There were no lights in the house, and Pilot said,
She either lives alone or her old man ain't home yet.
The old lady dropped the garage door and limped into the house, carrying a bag of groceries. They waited until she was inside, parked the truck in the street, and walked up to the door and knocked. The old lady came to the door and asked,
Can I help you?
Pilot said, Yeah, you can. He'd already checked the screen door to make sure that it was unlatched.
Now he yanked it open, put his hand in the old lady's face, and hurled her back against the entry wall where her head rebounded with a wet smack. Kristen came in behind Pilate and shut the door while Pilate kicked the old lady in the head 3 or 4 times. When Pilate was pretty sure she was dead, the two of them checked out the house. Everything suggested that the old lady lived alone, including a single plate and a cup and saucer sitting in the kitchen sink. They dragged the old woman to the basement stairs and threw her down, then went outside to move the vehicles. The second slot in the garage was half full of crap, boxes of family photographs, 30-year-old skis, corroding bicycles. They managed to clear enough space to fit the truck inside and pulled the doors down. Back inside, they checked the grocery bag, potatoes, grapes, milk, cereal. They found a couple of chicken pot pies in the refrigerator and half of a quart bottle of bourbon in the cupboard. "Everything we need," Pilate said. "We could hole up here for a couple days if we have to." But they couldn't, really. The UP was getting organized. They caught the 6 o'clock news and found out what had happened in Mellon, and that they were national celebrities. The cops had dug up a driver's license for Kristen Jones. Pilate said, "Jones? Jones?" and had excellent identikit images of Pilate. "While we're waiting to get out of here, we gotta change the way we look," he said. "You could shave your beard," Kristen said, "though I'd miss your little beard braids." "My beard? I'm gonna cut it all off. Beard, hair, everything. Shave my head. You could get one of those lesbo haircuts like Ellen had. Wonder what she's told the cops." They'd seen pictures of Ellen in handcuffs being led into a police station. "Probably everything," Pilate said. "I never trusted that bitch." They ate, talking about the fight in Mellon, the last things they'd seen, then went into the bathroom to cut their hair. Pilate looked at himself in the mirror and said, "You know, I can't cut it all off. I won't feel like myself. How about a soul patch?" The old lady had a wall of photos of herself and a man who must have been her husband, showing them through the years, with 4 children and then a bunch of grandchildren. One of the photos showed the old lady, many years younger, giving the man a haircut with an electric clipper as he sat on a wooden chair in a bathroom with a towel around his neck. They dug through the bathroom drawers and a linen closet, and, sure enough, found the clippers. The clippers were crude, and Pilate kept flinching when the clipper head yanked at his hair, but they got it done and finished the job, both his face and scalp, with a throwaway lady's razor. When she was finished, Pilate looked at himself in the bathroom mirror and said, "I hate this. I look about 20 fucking years older." "That's a good thing," Kristen said. "I'll tell you something else. Your head looks about half as big as it used to, and your nose looks twice as big. You don't look nothing like that drawing." Pilate cut Kristen's hair, taking his time, looking at the way her hair lay across her head, and when he finished, Kristen turned this way and that, looking in the mirror, and then said, "You know, maybe you should have been a hairdresser. Looks pretty good. Makes me look like a boy." They watched the news on satellite TV, and it was a scream fest. They caught CNN first, Wolf Blitzer, and then a local station out of Traverse City. Both CNN and the local station had video shot minutes after the shooting ended. The video had been shot by the woman artist who said she'd been held captive and had been threatened with rape by the disciples. She had apparently sold her video to every TV station in sight and complained that the Michigan State cops had confiscated her original memory card and camera. She'd seen that coming, though, and had saved the video to her laptop before the cops got to her. One of the videos showed a tall, thin cop firing a rifle out the window, while another one, with a pistol, huddled on the floor, watched. Before he pulled the trigger, they heard the thin cop say, quite clearly, "Fuck him!" And after he fired, the other cop walked to the window and look out, and then say, almost conversationally, "Nice shot." The camera then tracked down across the floor where a group of men surrounded a body on the floor, and then to another man who lay in a pool of blood. Kristen was sitting on the couch, eating a pot pie, and said, "Bell. Bell and Lane." Pilot said, "Motherfuckers, that could be us." Toward the end of the newscast, the anchorman asked people throughout the UP to check on their neighbors, but to do so carefully. "Don't just walk up to a house, but watch to see if your neighbors follow their usual routine. If something seems different, call the police and report your suspicions." "We gotta get out of here before daylight," Pilot said. "Maybe, I don't know, get as far away as we can in one day in the old lady's car, then take a bus or grab another car." They hadn't had any decent sleep for a long time, it seemed, and they crawled into the old lady's double bed after watching the news. At 5 o'clock in the morning, they ate cereal and milk, then rummaged through the old lady's closets and found hats and jackets that no Californian would ever wear. They also took the $30 in the old lady's purse, along with her driver's license and Visa card. When Kristen put on a wide-brimmed straw hat with a white bow, she looked in the mirror and said, "I'm a fucking church lady." "Church lady is good," Pilot said. Kristen said, "If you had a ring in your ear, you'd look like Mr. Clean." They gassed the car up at a station on the edge of town where a sleepy clerk told Kristen that the I-75 bridge was still blocked. With that option gone, they headed west on the far north side of the peninsula toward Duluth, Minnesota, 8 hours away. They found a road atlas in the car, which Pilot read as Kristen drove. "We'll be in Duluth before 3 o'clock. Can't go back to Pabst because they either caught Chet or killed him, and they'll be on to Pabst by now." A while later, he said, "If we go south to Minneapolis, we'll be good. Stay there overnight. Next day, drive to Kansas City, dump the car where they won't find it right away. Walmart parking lot. Catch a bus and we're good," Pilot said. Another while later, he added, "That big fucking cop and his nosy kid are from down there. That's something to think about." 24. Lucas said goodbye to the posse the next day at Pat's, the sandwich shop across the street from Laurent's office, shaking hands, slapping backs, reliving the shootout at Mellon, speculating on the location of Pilot and Kristen. The mood was frenetic, half excitement and half regret, still mixed with anger about the cops who'd been shot. Three of the four of them were still alive, but one had lost a leg. Everybody agreed that the fugitives certainly had Louis Frey's truck and were hiding somewhere. Best case, they're hiding in the woods. Worst case, they stuck it in somebody's garage where nobody'll find it for a while, killed the owners and holed up, Lucas said. This thing isn't over until you've nailed them down. Laurent said, "We'll get them. We will. By the way, you know, when you guys were sitting on a bench eating those ice cream cones and talking about who'd be playing you in the movies, guess who I got a call from this morning? It's some producer out in L.A. and he's talking about options and so on," Lucas said. "See you on the red carpet." In the end, Lucas got out of town a little before noon, drove too fast going home, and would have pulled into his driveway right at 8 o'clock if a couple of TV trucks hadn't been blocking it. He parked in the street behind the last TV truck, and a pretty blonde woman hopped out, and he said, "Oh, shit." Jennifer Carey and he had a relationship that went back a couple of decades. More than that, Lucas was the father of Carey's first daughter, who was now in high school. Carey had married another man long ago, who had more or less adopted Lucas's daughter,
not counting private school fees and college tuition, all of which was fine with Lucas. But Carrie still had the mojo on him. She couldn't read him as well as Weather could, but was still better than 50-50 on when he was lying. She was walking straight at him with a microphone thrust out at his face and a trailing cameraman. Another woman popped out of the lead truck, Annie McGowan, who was now anchoring at Channel 11. She rarely was on the street with a cameraman, but she was now, because she also had an edge on Lucas. Lucas did have one advantage. The two women were not friends, and a catfight was possible. Then he could arrest them both for assault, send them down to the Ramsey County Jail, and go to dinner. He got out of the car, fists on his hips, saw Letty jogging across the lawn. She came up and slapped hands with Carrie. Letty had interned at Carrie's TV station for 3 years as a high school student under Carrie's watchful eye. Letty nodded at McGowan and asked Lucas, "Where's Pilot?" "I don't know," Lucas said as the microphones came up. "The two best possibilities are that he's out in the woods somewhere in the UP, or that he made it across the Mackinac Bridge before we got the roadblocks up and is hiding out in Detroit."
"Do you think he'll surrender when he's caught?"
Carrie asked. "Depends on how it happens. He'll run as far as he can. If he's cornered and doesn't have any options, he'll quit. Fundamentally, he's a coward. When we caught up to them in Michigan, he organized his disciples for a fight. Then, when the fight started, he snuck out the back door and ran. Abandoned his so-called friends. Some of them were actually dying for him, and he was sneaking away into the woods." McGowan held up three fingers and asked,
"Do you think he'll surrender when he's caught?"
And then counted the fingers down, 1, 2, 3, which would allow her editors to cut her question in before Lucas's response. When she'd built in a little space for her editors, she turned to Letty with her enormous black eye and asked,
"Do you agree with your father? When you tried to save your friend, this Pilot beat you up." "That's all he's good at," Letty said, "beating up women. He kicked my friend Sky to death over in Wisconsin, and the guy they crucified in South Dakota was just a nice, gentle boy. Pilot is an enormous, I can't say it on TV, but he is one, a vicious one."
Carrie held up three fingers and asked Letty,
"Do you agree with your father? Pilot attacked you,"
then counted down 1, 2, 3. Lucas answered a few more questions and declined to answer some that he thought might be legally sensitive. "I can't actually answer all your questions because I'm being deposed tomorrow at the BCA. We'll send copies to all the departments involved in the case. Copies of the depositions should be available through the BCA whenever the authorities think they should be." He let the women get a couple of reverse shots over his shoulder, showing their faces in close-up, asking the questions they'd already asked, and then he called it off. "I gotta go say hello to my wife and get something decent to eat. I haven't had anything all day." When the cameras and microphones were off, McGowan said,
"I can see your handiwork in that Witch Daisy Jones getting the Honey Potts interview."
"Geez, Annie, try to be a little more understanding of an enterprising colleague," Lucas said.
"I was a little annoyed myself," Carrie said. "You really set that up?"
"I was out of town when she did that interview," Lucas said. "My hands are clean."
"How about your cell phone?"
Carrie asked. "Is that clean, too?"
"Jennifer,"
Lucas began. Then, "Listen, you guys have been here when I wasn't, and you hang around the courthouse. What are people saying about the Marion case?"
"I've heard that your old basketball buddy Park Raines started sniffing around for a deal about 5 minutes after that baluster came out of the ground," McGowan said.
Carrie said,
"I gotta say, he's one eminently fuckable attorney, in my opinion."
"You're right," said Letty.
Lucas, "Hey, not in front of the old man."
And he's even better than he looks,
McGowan said, with a moment of silence following. Then to Lucas,
anyway, the Ballister sealed the deal. I've even heard that Jim Bobson might take the case away from his boy prosecutor and give it to somebody more serious.
Carrie,
somebody must have briefed you on what Ballisters are.
Fuck you, McGowan said. Why would you fight with each other? Lucas asked. It's Daisy's tire treads that are running across both your chests. They both said at the same time,
fuck you,
Letty said brightly.
Everybody's feeling scrappy tonight, huh? The TV trucks left, and Lucas pulled the SUV into the garage and dropped the door.
Weather was inside reading microsurgery letters and said,
I hope you won't get in trouble for talking to those people.
Lucas kissed her on the forehead and said, you know, I don't care anymore about getting in trouble with anybody. Weather looked at him.
You're okay?
She meant the depression problem. I'm feeling pretty cheerful, Lucas said. I was working with a police force that was stripped down to almost nothing, and in some ways, it seems to work better than anything we've got in the Twin Cities. People in the UP know they have to take care of themselves because nobody else will. So they do.
All right, if you say so, she said. I reserve the right to smirk when it all goes wrong.
25. Pilot and Kristen, nervous as cats all the way across the Upper Peninsula and then Wisconsin, relaxed a notch as they crossed a bay off Lake Superior on Highway 53 and rolled into Duluth, Minnesota, past long lines of boxcars. They were two states away from the manhunt and that much safer. Pilot was driving and merged onto I-35 North and got off at Michigan Avenue. Kristen, looking out the window at the town, said,
there's a used clothes store around here. I can smell it. We need some different clothes. We look too L.A., like not from here.
What we really need to do is see a news program, find out what's going on, Pilot said. See if they found the old lady. If they find her and we don't know it and we're driving this car, we're toast. They drove around for a while, but didn't find a used clothes store. As they were about to give up, Kristen pointed to two oddly dressed women in funny hats waiting to cross the street and said,
stop there. We'll ask them.
The women were Catholic nuns, and one said,
why, yes. There's a place about 6 blocks that way, called Round It Goes. It's on the right, next to the bookstore. You can't miss it.
Being nuns, they didn't say that it was an adult bookstore, but Round It Goes was right next to it. 15 minutes into the store, they found a blue suit that fit Pilot with a light blue dress shirt and a striped necktie. His own shoes were acceptable, if a little too pointy. Kristen found a short-sleeved brown dress that dropped an inch below her knees and brown shoes with low, wide heels. She checked herself in the mirror and said,
I look like one of those nuns.
Which is about as far away from us as you could get, Pilot said. Nuns ain't pretty, but nuns is good. On a rack next to the door, Pilot found a white straw hat with a narrow brim, put it on, and asked Kristen, what do you think? She considered the hat, then said,
you look like somebody I know.
He dropped his voice. But not Pilot.
No, not Pilot.
The total bill came to $36, and they went to look for a TV. After two miscues, sports bars, they found a dark and nearly empty bar downtown, put on their sunglasses, went in, got beers served in a booth in the back where they could see the second-string television. There was a ball game on, but neither the bartender nor the other two patrons were looking at it, and Pilot asked the bartender if they could change stations to CNN or something like that.
Sure.
He used a remote to change stations, then said to Pilot, "You remind me of someone. Are you a musician?" "Play a little ukulele," Pilot joked as he headed back to the booth. They didn't have to order a second beer. CNN was in full disaster mode, with at least three reporters wandering around the UP. They seemed to be as astonished by the place as Pilot and the disciples had been. At one point, Wolf Blitzer said, "One of the key actors in this Northwoods clash, Agent Lucas Davenport of Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, has been out of touch all day as he drives back to Minnesota. We're hoping to have an interview with him this evening. In the meantime, the search continues for the ringleaders of the Los Angeles murder and drug gang who..." The identikit picture of Pilot came up, along with the photo of Kristen. The old lady hadn't been found. After the summary, Blitzer told out the dead. Pilot was transfixed as a reporter read the roll. The disciples had essentially been wiped out, save for a few who were jumped by the cops at the Sault Ste. Marie gathering, one who survived the Mellon shootout untouched, and one who was wounded at Mellon. CNN had all their full names, most of which Pilot never knew. "I'm amazed Lane was shot. If I'd thought any of them would have given up, it would have been her," Kristen said. "She's still got time to fuck us," Pilot said. Kristen leaned forward and whispered, "The bartender keeps looking down here at us. I think we're ringing a bell with him, maybe from the pictures." Pilot leaned toward her. "Wonder if he's called a cop." "I haven't seen him on the phone," she said. "Let's go. We've heard enough. Get out of here, get a motel down in the Twin Cities. We can watch the news tonight." She nodded and they pushed out of the booth. As they passed the bartender, he smiled broadly, snapped his fingers, and pointed at Pilot. "I got it. The ukulele tipped me off. Leon Redbone, right?" Kristen kept walking, but Pilot put his finger to his lips and said, "Don't tell." Then he was out the door. On the sidewalk, Kristen was biting into her arm so hard that later she found a little row of bruises where her pointed teeth cut into the skin. "Shut up," Pilot said. She tried to talk, but nothing came out but a low gurgling laugh until finally she gasped, "Leon, Redbone. Where's your fucking banjo, Leon?" She bit into her arm again as they walked back to the car. That night, in a motel on the airport strip in South Minneapolis, they watched the interview with Davenport and his daughter on Channel 3. "That motherfucker," Pilot said. "Coward. Only fights women. Ran out on his friends. He's smearing me. He's ruining my whole fucking reputation," Kristen said. "Keep your voice down, for Christ's sakes. They can hear you three rooms down. And what difference does it make? You can never be you again, ever. Fucking coward. Fucking coward. Keep your voice down." She'd seen him like this when he'd pick up an insult and turn it into a cataclysm. That's how they wound up killing Kitty Place, because another woman had insulted Pilot. Late that night, 3 o'clock, Kristen woke up and heard Pilot rattling something. She turned her head and opened her eyes. He was pointing his .45 at the darkened television. He said aloud, "Coward!" Pulled the trigger and the hammer fell with a metallic smack, and he racked the slide again. Letty came down the stairs wearing dark slacks, low heels, and a dark blue silk blouse, dressed up to talk to the cops. Lucas looked at her and thought that she'd never work undercover as a cop unless it was a very classy assignment. With her dark hair, she gave off a little too much of a private school vibe. Of course, if she focused on economics at Stanford, she could be a real undercover weapon if she investigated economic crime, where the criminals wore $5,000 suits. She looked at Lucas and said, "You look like a rich cop." Lucas was wearing a navy blue suit,
English loafers, and a very pale blue shirt made in France. Why not a banker? Bankers don't have noses that are crooked from being broken or scars like yours. But cops do. I mean, look at Jenkins or Shrake.
Please, Lucas said. And,
you ready to go?
We need to stop at a Caribou for some iced coffee.
Not a problem.
The day was perfect. Low 80s, bluebird sky, the slightest touch of a breeze. If the Minnesota August lasted all year, nobody would live anywhere else.
That hadn't always been true, he told Letty as they went out to the Porsche.
There had been the whole era of the infamous St. Paul smell, but that was gone now. Forever, he hoped, because it had been nasty.
They made it to the BCA in 25 minutes with a stop at Caribou Coffee so that Letty could get a cold press iced coffee and a Diet Coke and scone for Lucas, and they dropped the top on the car and took their time. Sands was waiting in an adjoining office talking to an agent, but jumped up the instant he saw Lucas and Letty.
Lucas, we gotta talk.
He looked at Letty, recognized her, and said, Your daughter can wait in your office. The minute they got in his office, Sands turned around and poked a finger at Lucas, raised his voice and said, What the hell have you been doing out there? You had responsibilities here, and instead, you go tearing around the countryside, not even in Minnesota. You get four cops shot and one of them killed.
Don't shout at me, Henry, Lucas said. He said it calmly enough, but Henry took a quick step backward.
You don't fucking threaten me, Davenport. I've had enough of this shit. Your goddamn gang operating however they want. That fucking Flowers pisses off a state senator who's still calling me.
I didn't threaten you, Henry. In fact, I'm in the process of reevaluating my position at the BCA. I don't think I'm up high enough in the food chain to avoid the bullshit. I'm gonna talk to the governor about moving me up another step or two so I can do some actual investigation instead of sending my men out to blow moronic state senators.
Sands put up both hands, said,
Okay, okay. You talk to whoever you want, but the first thing you do is you figure out how you're going to pay for this little excursion to Michigan. What are you gonna do when we get sued by some...
I'll pay for it. Lucas said. If we get sued and lose, I'll pay for it. I'll pay for my own mileage, my own hotels. Won't put in for any overtime. Henry, we wiped out a gang that butchered at least 10 innocent people and quite possibly more, including a crucifixion. You want me to go on television and tell people that Henry Sands disallowed my travel expenses for killing off a gang that slashed an actress to death and crucified a young boy from Texas. You want to be famous?
I think I can manage it, Lucas said. You're threatening me again, Sands said.
I'd never threaten you, Lucas said. If I got to that point, I'd just bust your fucking nose.
In the meantime, Lucas gave him the finger.
Fuck you.
Hey, hey!
Sands's voice cut off when Lucas pulled the door shut. Lucas and Letty gave their statements about the Wisconsin part of the investigation, sticking close to the statement they'd given the Sawyer County Sheriff's Department. Lucas expanded into the conflict in the Upper Peninsula. Everybody called them depositions, but they weren't really. Because there was no swearing in, or an opposition attorney to monitor them. Real depositions would come later if somebody decided to sue. Given the viciousness of Pilate and the disciples, Lucas thought that successful suits would be thin on the ground. The statements took an hour and a half, then they shook hands all around, and Lucas and Letty stopped at Lucas's office on the way out. Dell was sitting there, reading a hippie newspaper, and when he saw them coming, he shook his head.
I understand you got harsh with Henry.
I let it out a little, Lucas agreed. Why?
There's a hot rumor going around that he's going to bring you up on a bunch of charges, try to get you fired, or at least suspended for, you know, months. Demoted, probably.
Lucas smiled and said, "Well, as some great philosopher should have once said, it is what it is. Don't worry about it, Del. Though you might want to keep your head down, avoid as much of the stink as possible."
"Lucas, the whole group is talking about ways to back you up. We're all with you."
"Easy, man, I got this," Lucas said. Lucas got his briefcase, and he and Letty headed out of the building. Crossing the parking lot, Letty said,
"Del's a good friend."
"Yes, he is. So are Flowers and Jenkins and Shrake and Elle and Katrin and a half dozen other people. Some of them aren't really friends, but they're okay, like Schaffer. I didn't like him, but he did a good job, and he didn't like me. But he knew I held my end up, so we were fine with each other. Other people, like Sands, they're a drag on the system. They're our biggest problem. There are too many bureaucrats, and all they worry about is sucking on the neck of whoever's paying them. Just the way it goes." 2 minutes later, they were out on Maryland Avenue, headed for I-35, neither one of them saying much, comfortable with not talking. Letty was driving. Pilot said, "There they are." He was parked on Phelan Boulevard, looking slightly down into the BCA parking lot. Kristen whimpered,
"Let's get out of here. Pilot, they'll kill us."
"Shut up. They're not gonna kill us. We'll get them away from here, out in the open, and boom."
"Yeah, boom."
Davenport and his daughter had gotten out of the slick-looking Porsche and, leaving the top down, went inside the building. He said on TV he was just going to make a statement. Couldn't take long. "You're driving. I got the gun," Pilot said. "If we get down a quiet street where we could pull up beside them, all we need is 5 seconds to get away from the scene, and we're gone."
"This is so fucking crazy. They're gonna kill us."
"You think I'm a fucking coward? You think I'm a fucking coward, don't you?" It went on like that, back and forth, with growing silences between outbursts, and they waited and waited some more. And it was almost 2 hours before Davenport and his kid came out of the building and got back in the Porsche, the girl in the driver's seat. "We look for a quiet block," Pilot said. "They'll be moving slow on the city streets, right out in the open in that little car." Letty took them out to I-35 and back toward home, easing onto I-94, then speeding up, slashing through the traffic. Lucas said nothing because she'd learned from him, and he was enjoying the ride. They got off at Creighton, and she took the left at the top of the ramp, got caught by a red light at Marshall. Letty asked,
"Do you think I'm paranoid?"
"You mean like you're starting to think I might cut off your Amex?" She looked at him with cool, serious eyes.
"No. Would you believe me if I said I think we're being followed by two people in an old car?"
Lucas smiled and said,
"Yeah, I'd believe you."
He looked straight ahead, then glanced into the right-wing mirror. "Which one is it?"
"That old red car, like a station wagon. It's about 6 cars back in the left lane. I kind of noticed it when we were coming out of the parking lot. I thought I saw somebody inside, but they, like, ducked. When we were going down Maryland, I saw them turning behind us. Then we got to I-35, and they got behind us there, too, but stayed back, and they followed us to I-94. When I sped up, they did, too, but they still stayed back. Now they're still behind us."
"God damn it, it could be them," Lucas said. "I've been shooting off my mouth on TV about what assholes they are, and they're crazy. I even told them where we'd be today when I talked to Jennifer and Annie last night. They couldn't get out of the UP going south,
So if they did get out going west, they could be here.
Now what? Letty asked.
Let me think, Lucas said.
A minute later, he said, Okay, here's the deal. Don't let them catch us. Keep going straight south, all the way to Ford Parkway, then hook over to Cleveland. Go all the way down to Highway 5, then over to the Mall of America.
Why the mall?
Because it's full of cops, Lucas said. And the Bloomington chief is a friend of mine, and he can have things set up by the time we get there. And it's a logical destination.
Lucas got through to the chief on the chief's personal cell phone, explained the situation.
Here's what I want to do. You know when you get off 494 onto Cedar, then you slide over and go up and then down that ramp that curves over in front of Nordstrom's?
Yeah, Lindau Lane.
That's it. With all those roads going through there, Lindau is like a concrete chute. If there's shooting, it shouldn't be a problem. We won't kill any bystanders. If you have a couple cars down around the bend where it turns by Nordstrom's, he won't be able to see them until he's right at the roadblock, and there's no way out of the chute.
I get the concept, the chief said. We'll put a couple of unmarked cars north of 494, and they'll fall in behind them, so when he comes around the corner, we'll have him boxed.
Gonna need some guys who are willing to shoot, Lucas said. If these assholes think they're gonna die, they'll try to take us with them.
Keep your phone open. I'll be calling you, the chief said.
Letty said to Lucas,
Still back 4 or 5 cars.
Try not to clip a light and leave them behind.
Where in the hell are they going? Pilot asked.
Don't know. I almost lost her on the freeway. She drives like she's in L.A., and this piece of shit drives like it's still back in Michigan, Kristen said.
They got down to Highway 5, followed Lucas and Letty past the airport where it merged with I-494, then Pilot saw a sign for the mall.
They're going to that Mall of America. Man, that's great. We follow them right to their parking space, slow down, I nail the guy, and we go. So many cars out there, so many people, so much noise, we'll be lost in 5 seconds.
I don't know, man, I don't know.
Then they could see the mall south of the highway, Pilot said. Doesn't look that big. The malls in L.A. are twice as big.
Lucas said, Easy now.
I really love this shit, Letty said.
Letty, goddammit.
Well?
Okay, okay.
There's the off-ramp, she said.
It almost worked. The red Taurus, Lucas had picked it out in the wing mirror, followed them right off I-494 and then down and up again on the Lindau Lane chute. Lucas saw 2 boring, unmarked sedans jostle through traffic and get in behind the Taurus. Cop cars. The Taurus kept coming. Lucas said, We've got them boxed. Speed up, fast now. Hit it and stay right. Letty dropped 2 gears and floored it, and the Porsche virtually leapt down the chute.
Don't scrape the fenders! Jesus, don't scrape the fucking fenders!
The car's soft, fat tires were squealing their hearts out when Letty went around the curve to the left, and ahead saw 4 squad cars on the ramp with a small gap on the right side, big enough for her to get through. She'd gained 200 yards on the Taurus, and it was now out of sight behind the curve. Letty didn't slow down as they approached the gap, and a couple of Bloomington cops on foot, who had apparently expected her to ease through it, jumped back. Lucas said, Jesus, Jesus, as the concrete wall flew past a foot from his nose. Through the gap, Letty hit the brakes hard. Lucas surged forward in his safety belt, and when they were stopped, he looked at her and opened his mouth, but nothing came out, and she smiled and said, Not a scratch. He popped his safety belt and jumped out. Stay down. As soon as Letty had gone through the gap, one of the waiting Bloomington cop cars moved into it.
that's when the glitch developed. The Porsche suddenly leapt away from them. Kristen screamed, What are they doing? Did they see us?
I don't know, I don't. Kristen had accelerated in a futile attempt to keep up,
and when she came around the turn, she had barely enough time to stop before hitting the cop cars that were blocking the road. An ugly yellow car was right on her tail, and she yelled, Cops behind us!
As they screeched to a stop, the car fishtailed a little, and Pilot popped the door and disappeared.
Where did he go?
She didn't know. She got out of the car and held up her hands, heard cops shouting at her, and she stood still but twisted her neck around looking for Pilot. He had vanished. Then she saw Davenport running away from her, down the ramp, a gun in his hand, and a few cops trailing, running hard. Pilot knew it was over. The cops were going to kill him. Before the car had even stopped, he was out, and he took 3 steps to the concrete railing and looked down. 15 feet. He slipped over the railing, hung for a minute, then let go, landing on the grass below. Something popped and pain surged through 1 foot, and he felt like his asshole had kept going when his body stopped. He ran under the ramp for a few seconds, but couldn't stay there, and he darted across a narrow street between 2 oncoming cars and into a bunch of small trees and headed for Nordstrom's door. He kept thinking, gonna make it, gonna make it, gonna make it. He was wearing the blue suit with the .45 in his pocket, and he took the gun out as he ran. He jacked the shell into the chamber when they were tracking Davenport. He came up to Nordstrom's, expecting to be hit between the shoulder blades at any minute, realized that the cops couldn't shoot because of the crowd ahead of him. Crowds were his friends now. Off to his left, he got a glimpse of somebody coming after him and realized that Davenport was only 100 feet away. Pilot blew into Nordstrom's at a dead run, passed a big bearded guy in a Green Bay jersey, knocked a kid down, then another one, like bowling pins, almost went down himself, and somebody yelled, Hey! And he went straight on ahead, clothes, shoes, purses, and cosmetics. He could see the exit to the mall proper, and he glanced back, and Davenport had closed the gap. He didn't have time to turn and shoot, so he lifted the gun straight up and fired into the ceiling. Choppers shrieked and scattered in all directions, which helped a little, but not enough. He risked another look back, and Davenport was even closer, and he had a gun. Then he was out of the store, looking for any kind of help he could get. When Pilot fired into the ceiling and the crowd exploded into the aisles, Lucas was probably only 50 feet behind. He couldn't shoot because of all the people milling around him, and in the shooting lanes behind Pilot. Even if he hit Pilot in the middle of the back, the slug could go on through and clip a bystander. Pilot went straight out the store exit into the mall, then bent to the right around the escalators. Lucas went wider right to make sure he wouldn't be ambushed. He wasn't. Pilot had gone straight ahead and vaulted the counter at the Caribou Coffee, where he had a heavy young woman by her blonde hair, his pistol aimed more or less at her face. Lucas came around the escalator, and Pilot screamed, Get away from me! I wanna... Lucas never found out what he wanted. A getaway car? An airplane to North Korea? A spaceship? He never found out because the young woman picked up the large soy macchiato that she had been steaming and flipped it over her shoulder into Pilot's eyes. Pilot screamed and pulled away from her, and in that sliver of opportunity, Lucas shot him through the bridge of his nose. Then the screaming really got started. 26. Lucas's previous experience with the media was dwarfed by the response the cops got on the mall shooting, partly because one of the local TV stations initially referred to the shooting as an apparent terrorist attack. Later, they pulled back to apparent domestic terrorism attack, and finally to a shooting. An extremely attractive PR woman for Nordstrom's dashed around from one media group to the next, chanting, The shooting was in the mall. It was not in Nordstrom's. The shooting was in the mall. It was not.
The shooting, of course, became known as the Nordstrom Shootout. The egg laid by Henry Sands dwarfed all previous eggs by an order of magnitude. A shootout at Nordstrom's? And it was planned? Informed of Sands's reaction, the Bloomington chief, who thought the matter had been handled rather well, given the freakishly successful parachute jump by pilot, said, "I think Director Sands should check his head." That was enough of a non sequitur that somebody at the press conference inevitably asked, "Why?" The chief said, "Because right now it's where the sun don't shine." The chief pointed out that one crazed killer was captured alive and another was killed after a courageous action by a brave, quick-thinking coffee clerk, and no bystanders were hurt. Who was Sands to denigrate that from an office in St. Paul? Caribou Coffee gave the clerk a $100 gift card. When word got out, they upped it to $1,000. The shooting took place a little after noon, and Lucas and Letty pulled into their driveway at 6 o'clock. Weather came to the door and stood on the porch with her arms crossed. "Hmm," Letty said. "Reamed" was the appropriate description of what happened next, Lucas and Letty agreed later. When the reaming slowed, Weather gave Lucas a letter from the BCA, delivered by special messenger. Inside, Lucas found a letter saying that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was considering the bringing of disciplinary charges against Lucas, and his attendance was required at a meeting the following Tuesday at 10 a.m. The letter said that it would be appropriate for Lucas to seek legal counsel. It was signed by Sands.
"What are you going to do?"
Weather asked him. "Don't know." The next morning, Lucas drove a few blocks across the neighborhood to Willie's American Guitars and, after a long consultation, wrote a check for a little more than $10,000 for a vintage Les Paul guitar. It wasn't the most expensive one, but neither was it the cheapest. He at first quailed at the price, but then thought the Fago-throwing fat guy may have saved Letty's life. He had the store ship the guitar, which they would do as soon as the check cleared. Laurent called on a cell phone, on speaker, with the rest of the reserve deputies standing around, and asked him for a blow-by-blow description of the Nordstrom shooting. Lucas gave it to them, and Frizzell said, "Man, I wish I'd been there." "We all do," Laurent said. Lucas gave Laurent the license plate numbers on the red Taurus, and the Sault Ste. Marie police tracked it to the old lady's house. They found her at the bottom of the stairs. When Laurent called Lucas back to tell him, he said, "The only thing about the whole fight that really mystifies me is those two naked people. Why the hell did they do that?"
"I don't know," Lucas said. "Maybe they thought they could be decoys and that coon guy would take out all of us. But really, I don't know. Remember, they were crazy."
"Still bothers me," Laurent said. "Another thing, the congressman from up here says he's retiring, so there'll be an open seat next year. A Democratic Party guy got in touch, wondering if I might be interested. The funny thing is, a guy from the Republican Party got in touch with Peters."
"I got no advice on that, but I'll be interested in what you decide," Lucas said.
"I'm not sure you're enough of an asshole."
"Maybe I could learn it," Laurent said. "I don't know. Sometimes I think it's a skill you're born with. Or not."
Laurent called again late that afternoon to say that Lane, in consultation with her state-appointed attorneys, had told the state cops about the murder of Michelle. Her body was located the next morning by a state road crew. The governor's chief weasel called and said,
"Hold for the governor."
Lucas held, and Elmer Henderson came on.
"There's a rumor going around that Henry's going to try to fire your ass. Conduct unbecoming a BCA agent. Insubordination, blah, blah, blah."
"Well, I've been advised to seek legal counsel," Lucas said.
You want me to fire him instead? Henderson asked. He could resign on Monday.
Lucas thought for a moment, then said, I appreciate the thought, and the agency would be better off, but don't do that. Everybody would know what happened, and when you start running for the vice presidency, the Republicans will look for every single thing they can get on you. An accusation of blatant meddling wouldn't help.
We can crush that in a couple of minutes, Henderson said.
You might not have a couple of minutes to spare when the Henderson-Hoagie thing gets out there.
What? What? Lucas, where did you hear that phrase?
Governor, every sentient being in Minnesota's heard it. They admire you for it. Whether it'll play in, say, Colorado or Oregon, I don't know.
Lucas heard Henderson ask the weasel, Is that true, that everybody in Minnesota knows?
The weasel said,
Yes.
The Henderson-Hoagie referred to the governor's fondness for three and four ways with nubile young Seven Sisters co-eds while he was a student at Harvard. Supposedly, ketchup was involved.
Henderson came back. Well, whatever happens with Sands, come talk to me afterwards. At the end of the week, an FBI friend called to tell Lucas that the feds had been through both the fingerprint and DNA data banks and had found no matches at all for Pilot. He'd had two driver's licenses in his wallet, both from California, one for a Robert D. Johnson and another for a William S. Smith. Both were apparently obtained by fraud. Nobody had any idea who he really was. And a cop from North Dakota called and said he'd encountered the Pilot group at a restaurant and had taken down the license plate numbers of every one of their cars. By the time he found out that somebody might have needed them, the fight was over. On Sunday morning at breakfast, Weather asked him for the fifth or sixth time, You know what you're going to do?
Lucas nodded. Yeah.
I got a box in the garage, she said. How'd you know I'd need a box?
That afternoon, he climbed the steps to the BCA. Not many people were around, but an agent leaving the building stopped on the stairs, looked at him with the box, and said, Don't do it, man.
Lucas shook his hand and said, Thanks for the thought.
He'd been in this particular office for 7 years, but he had never been much for stuffing it with personal items. He started packing what was there, and a couple more investigators came to the office door, the female carrying another box. She said, Let us help you with that.
Okay.
They cleaned the place out in 15 minutes. Then Lucas got a piece of official stationery, wrote, Dear Henry, I quit. On a personal note, go fuck yourself. He put his ID inside the envelope, wrote Sands's name on the outside, and slid it under Sands's office door. The mail agent said, Succinct. Succinct is always good in inner office communications. The agents walked out to his Porsche with the two boxes, and the female agent said, I'll never forget the night up in the swamp. And she went on for a while about a dark night with Lucas and his gang of agents when she killed the man. Lucas peeled off his sport coat and his shoulder holster, dropped the coat and gun on the passenger seat. The woman agent finally ran down. They all shook hands, and Lucas got out of there before things turned maudlin. He'd still have to call Dell, Jenkins, Schrake, Flowers, and a few others. He'd do that in the evening. When he got home, he ran the garage door up and Letty came through from the kitchen. Watched him get out of the car and asked, You're retired now? You're gonna go sit in a goddamn rowboat for the next 30 years? Don't know what I'm gonna do, he said. You gotta do something. He grinned at his worried blue-eyed child. I'll find something. And I promise you this, it won't involve a goddamn rowboat.
Good, she said.
She picked up the .45 off the passenger seat.
Then you're gonna need this.
Lucas took the gun.
This is Richard Ferrone. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Gathering Prey by John Sanford. This program was directed by John McElroy, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2015 by John Sanford. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA LLC, a Penguin Random House company. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.